certified medical examiner, didn't make much sense. Hain had been offered and accepted the job despite lacking certification, so it's unclear why he would suddenly be so concerned about that particular qualification. He had also told the Clarion Ledger that he planned to take the certification exam the following spring. A new DPS commissioner, Louisa Dixon, expressed disappointment in Hain's resignation, as did many of the state's coroners. Even if Hain had only taken the job as a public service until a more qualified candidate could be found, it made little sense for him to resign before a successor had been identified. In a 2001 deposition, Hain offered an alternate explanation. He testified that he resigned because Dixon wanted another individual and had selected someone, but that his own lack of certification was never an issue. In a 2012 deposition, Hain would claim that he resigned because Dixon had barred him from lobbying the legislature for more money. That, too, didn't make much sense. Dixon herself has advocated for more funding for the office for her entire career. In 2008, she wrote a long op-ed in the Clarion Ledger in which she declared that having one doctor doing nearly all of the state's autopsies endangers public safety. There is one explanation for Hain's decision that makes a lot more sense. Hain's brief tenure may have helped him see a way to make a lot of money in the autopsy business. Prior to his appointment, most of Hain's forensic autopsy work had come from his association with Jimmy Roberts. From his perch in Jackson, Hain got a view of the entire state. In 1987, coroners and other local officials had ordered autopsies for 836 of the 8,000 deaths in Mississippi. Hain performed about 107 of those autopsies that year as state medical examiner. The other 729 were split up among other doctors, none of whom were forensic pathologists, and few of whom really wanted to be doing them. A doctor who could take on just half the number of autopsies the state contracted out in 1987 would gross 140% more than the $65,000 salary of the state medical examiner. And that wouldn't include the money one might get for lab work and court testimony. Take on more than 400 state autopsies, add in some private autopsies and testimony for plaintiff's attorneys, and an energetic state medical examiner could easily gross 5, 6, or 7 times his base salary. But there was a hitch. Just a couple months prior to his resignation, the Department of Public Safety received a complaint that two employees of the crime lab had been moonlighting as autopsy assistants. Commissioner Dixon ruled that DPS employees weren't permitted to moonlight in the same field as their employment with the state. While he was in office, Hain had seen firsthand just how much money there was to be made from doing autopsies as a private physician instead of as a state employee. If he had any notion of trying to do both, the DPS prohibition on freelancing effectively eliminated that option. But if he resigned, he'd be free to do as many autopsies for county coroners and prosecutors as he pleased. In an interview with the Clarion Ledger, Thomas Bennett, who had apparently spoken to Hain about his decision to resign, told the paper that Hain made it very clear that he was going to go with his private work because that was his first love. It was also far more lucrative. This, of course, is speculation. It's impossible to say if this is precisely how Hain's thinking evolved. But it certainly fits neatly with the chronology. Hain accepted the acting position, where he would have seen just how many autopsies were being done statewide. Then Dixon issued her ban on moonlighting. And then Hain resigned. Immediately after resigning, Hain's autopsy load began to increase, rather dramatically. There's a good reason why stories about Southern injustice, cronyism, and good old boy politics inevitably come back to racism. And in this story, too, there's no question that Hain and West thrived in a system that was created and honed during Jim Crow, and that for decades was used to reinforce the segregated social order. There's also no question that the system's problems continue to disproportionately affect minority and poor populations across the state. But no one has described Hain as a racist. He married a black detective in 2006, although the marriage itself was short. In the 1990s, his findings assisted state and federal prosecutors in reopening several cold civil rights murder cases from the 1960s. Instead, Hain could be described more as an opportunist. He was quick to accommodate, whether it was a backwater sheriff or prosecutor, or a media-savvy attorney general or U.S. attorney trying to make a name for himself by prosecuting elderly Klansmen. On the rare occasion that the Mississippi death investigation system would come under fire during Hain's reign, the major players would claim they were only doing the best they could with a bad situation. Prosecutors and coroners claimed that there were simply no other medical examiners available. Hain, West, and Roberts claimed they were merely doing what was asked or required of them. But all of that glosses over the fact that the system Mississippi had was exactly the system that all the important players wanted. It's the system they created, and the system they've fought like hell to preserve. Chapter 7. The West Phenomenon. All talents, all gifts that I possess are directed straightly from God. I feel that the Lord wants me to work in this arena. It is a good fight. Michael West. In 1982, 30-year-old dentist Michael West attended a lecture by a Kansas forensic odontologist named Thomas Krause. In the lecture, delivered to the annual convention of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences, West heard Krause explain some experiments he had been doing with bite marks and ultraviolet photography. The field of bite mark analysis had blossomed since attracting national attention during the trial of infamous serial murderer Ted Bundy 6 years earlier. But practitioners had been limited by the fact that bite marks seemed to begin healing after just a few days. Krause claimed that ultraviolet photography could detect marks that had been left months earlier. West, a budding forensic odontologist himself, ran with the idea. When he returned home to Hattiesburg, Mississippi, West and another local dentist named Felder Buddy Wallace conducted an odd series of experiments. West shaved a patch of skin on his thigh, while Wallace sedated him with drugs normally used in tooth extraction. Once West was under, Wallace bit West on the thigh. He had to do so aggressively to mimic what forensic odontology textbooks called a combat bite, a bite administered during an attack. Soon West and Wallace were paying their assistants and criminal justice students at the University of Southern Mississippi to bite one another. Once the bitee was sedated, the biter would chomp down and then hold the bitee's skin between his or her teeth for 15 seconds until West hollered time. From their tests, West and Wallace claimed to have replicated Krause's experiment, telling the local paper that they could recreate bite marks left 3 months earlier on men and 6 months earlier on women. West claimed women have an extra layer of fat, which he said preserves the scarring for a longer period of time. We've taken a lot of good humor from lay individuals who don't fully understand what we're trying to do, West said. The following year, West would testify in the first ever Mississippi criminal trial to include bite mark evidence. In March 1982, a black man broke into the home of a white 37-year-old Hattiesburg woman, assaulted her, and raped her. The victim could only describe her assailant as tall, black, and soft-spoken. According to District Attorney Bud Holmes, the woman's attacker had bitten her on the cheek. West noted an alleged bite mark, photographed it, performed his own analysis, and matched it to a suspect. Holmes then sent West's photos of the mark and a dental mold of the suspect to two other bite mark specialists for confirmation. West had not yet been certified by the American Board of Forensic Odontology, so Holmes wanted confirmation from another bite mark analyst, in case West wasn't permitted to testify. One of the bite mark specialists didn't agree with West's conclusion. The other did. The expert who agreed with West happened to be Richard Souveron, one of the forensic odontologists who had achieved some fame in the Ted Bundy trial. On February 17, 1983, Holmes charged 24-year-old Don Horn for the rape. Horn, as it turns out, was a 3-year starter and standout wide receiver for the University of Southern Mississippi football team. After the charge, the NFL prospect was suspended from the school. Prosecutors began looking at Horn after the victim identified him as one of 4 black men she knew. She also shopped at a grocery store where Horn worked as a stock clerk, and Horn was a patient of the dentist where the victim worked as a hygienist. Prosecutors also later pointed out that stock clerks at the grocery store sometimes used box cutters to open shipments, and that the victim said her assailant wielded a box cutter. Not only was Horn's trial the first Mississippi case to include bite mark evidence, the bite mark evidence was the only real evidence against him. Despite Holmes's assertions to the press, it would turn out to be the only physical evidence against Horn. Semen taken from the victim was inconclusive, the fingerprints found in the home didn't match Horn, and lab analysts could only say that pubic hair found on the victim had come from a black man. Horn also had an alibi. On the night of the rape, he had slept at his girlfriend's house after serving as an usher at her brother's wedding. Horn was tried the following December. It looked bleak for him before the first witness had even been called. The prosecutors had used their challenges to remove all the black candidates from the jury pool, leaving an all-white panel. Then Horn's attorneys objected to letting West testify, pointing out that he had never given bite mark testimony and that he wasn't certified as a forensic odontologist. The judge ruled against them. When he took the stand, West testified that the mark on the victim was a dead match to Don Horn. He relied only on marks from the lower teeth for his conclusion, and in fact didn't even bother bringing his photographs of the upper marks. Richard Souveron also testified that the marks were a match. Norman Sperber, the other expert to whom Holmes had originally sent West's photos, testified for the defense. He told the jury the marks were inconsistent with Horn's teeth. Despite allowing both West and Souveron to take the stand, the trial judge refused to allow a second defense expert to testify about the bite. Remarkably, in spite of all of that, Horn was acquitted. Horn's trial was both the first bite mark case in Mississippi history and the first in which Michael West testified as a bite mark expert. It resulted in an acquittal, and yet no one seemed chastened by that outcome. West had already been lecturing at state law enforcement conferences about bite mark evidence, and continued to do so. The following year, he and Wallace were slated to give their own presentation on ultraviolet photography at the annual American Academy of Forensic Sciences conference. District Attorney Bud Holmes told the Hattiesburg American that though he lost, he was pleased to have participated in a case that would be remembered as a milestone in Mississippi criminal law. "It's tantamount to the first time fingerprints or blood type was used," he said, referring to the bite mark evidence. "As it becomes perfected, it will be very useful." Michael West was born on September 11, 1952, in New Orleans. He grew up in Picayune, a town of about 10,000 people in southwest Mississippi, wedged between the Louisiana border and the Gulf Coast. In 1971, he enrolled at Pearl River Community College and then transferred to the University of Southern Mississippi, where 2 years later he earned a Bachelor of Science degree. West earned his DDS from Louisiana State University in 1977 and served active duty in the Air Force Dental Corps from 1977 to 1981. By 1981, he had set up a dental practice in Hattiesburg, the college town of about 45,000 people, 90 miles southeast of Jackson. A portly man with thick fingers and a drawl as thick as sausage gravy, West was brash, ambitious, and, at times, breathtakingly reckless. His rapid ascent in the world of forensics from the late 1980s through the mid-1990s is a striking example of just how deferential and unskeptical courts, police, journalists, and juries can be when it comes to expert testimony. Many of West's claims about his forensic abilities should have been suspect to anyone willing to give them some serious thought. Yet prosecutors, as well as police chiefs, sheriffs, and others in law enforcement, rarely thought to double-check them with actual scientists before putting West in front of a jury. West often portrayed himself as a sophisticated pioneer of forensics, but also an everyman grounded in common sense and folksy humility. Juries ate it up. He once told lawyers at a deposition, unprompted, that he had been reading a book on the Gnostic Christians and another on quantum mechanics. But he also wasn't too fancy for a working man's beer. "While I'm drinking Miller High Lifes, I'm working on my magnum opus on why Galileo was wrong," he said. "I've just got to get the Pope to read it." This ivory tower blue-collar dichotomy also appears in West's contradictory descriptions of how he got started in forensic dentistry, which he traces back to his time in the Air Force. In a 2012 deposition, West said his interest in forensics began when an Air Force colonel needed a forensic specialist. "So the colonel came in and he looked around the room. I was the lowest-ranking man. He said I was forensic officer." But later in the same deposition, West claimed he was given the job because he was, in his words, a boy wonder. "I was a quick study. Whenever a difficult case would come up, Colonel Calloway would assign it to me." In 1982, West, Buddy Wallace, and West's former dental school classmate Robert Barsley received some local notoriety for their work identifying the remains of some of the 152 passengers killed when Pan Am Flight 759 crashed just after takeoff from a New Orleans airport. It's unclear why West and Wallace stopped working together, but West and Barsley would go on to co-write numerous articles. In 1991, the two men received a grant from the National Institute for Justice for an experiment similar to the one West and Wallace had conducted nearly 10 years earlier. They paid married couples to bite one another and then examined the resulting wound patterns. According to West, they paid one spouse $100 to be sedated and bitten, and the other $50 to do the biting. The two dentists then used ultraviolet light to examine the marks and photograph the wounds over successive days. According to West, "We're getting better images of the pattern 19 days after it was inflicted than we could an hour after it was inflicted." Though West often cited the NIJ grant as an important credential, the results of his experiments with both Wallace and Barsley have not been duplicated by other researchers. In one article published in a law enforcement magazine in 1992, West and Barsley took the method to another level. They claimed they had used it to discern what had really happened during an altercation in which a man was killed with a police officer's gun. The man's family believed the officer unjustifiably shot the man. The officer claimed the man had wrested the officer's service revolver away and mistakenly shot himself. West and Barsley claimed that by using ultraviolet light, they found indentations in the man's skin that were invisible to the naked eye. Moreover, the two concluded that those indentations could only have come from gripping the officer's gun. Even if they'd inspected the man's hands immediately after the incident, it was a spurious claim. But they hadn't. Their exam took place well after the shooting. This is the sort of claim West would make over and over again. 2 years after graduating from dental school, West leveraged the publicity he received from the Pan Am crash to start a business, Dental Disaster Squad, which aimed to provide rapid response dental identification in the event of a plane crash, fire, or other tragedy. In 1984, he received his certification in forensic odontology from the American Board of Forensic Odontology. A year later, he was named Coroner Pro Tem for Forest County, Mississippi. As West has testified, he was offered the position because, at the time, the elected coroner for Forest County had a problem with drinking. When the coroner's drinking began to interfere with his ability to conduct death investigations, the local district attorney and other law enforcement officials approached West and asked him to take over the job, but informally, behind the scenes. West has said that law enforcement came to him specifically because he was known to the court and the DA as an individual in forensics. Over the years, West has also claimed to have been appointed Deputy Coroner Ranger, Deputy Coroner Medical Examiner Investigator, Chief Deputy Coroner, and Coroner Medical Examiner Investigator, all titles that describe what is essentially the same position. He was an assistant coroner. Early on, West won some fawning profiles in the local media. The first was a 1983 piece in the Hattiesburg American on the biting experiments he had conducted with Wallace. It ran under the headline, "Taking a Bite Out of Crime." In 1988, the same paper ran a big photo of West holding an ultraviolet camera he was given after presenting a paper about identifying wound patterns. That article began, "Most people probably don't think of Hattiesburg as a hotbed of scientific research." The same year, West's hometown paper featured him again, this time in a front-page story about how West and another local researcher had used video enhancement to prove that President John F. Kennedy was killed by a lone gunman. According to his curriculum vitae, between 1989 and 1999, Michael West published 51 articles, made 50 presentations, and gave 84 lectures. By 1995, he claimed to have given lectures on a tour of China, at the FBI Academy in Quantico, Virginia, and to the detectives at Scotland Yard in England. He also claimed his research was monitored by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, Israeli intelligence, and police agencies all over the world. West has published articles on a wide array of topics. A sampling of titles from his curriculum vitae include "A New Method for Trace Metal Verification," "A Study of Surface Topography of Footwear and Automobile Pedals," "Serial Mass Murders, A Study of Mass Violence," "Confirmation of the Single Bullet Theory in the Assassination of President John F. Kennedy," "A Second Look at Wax," "The Hidden Danger of Scalding," and "Peanut Butter Aspiration Deaths Among the Mentally Retarded." He and Stephen Hain collaborated on dozens of articles and presentations, often working on them together at the local Waffle House after their nighttime autopsy sessions. By 2006, West's CV stood at 27 pages. He had testified more than 80 times and claimed to have investigated 5,800 deaths. In a deposition just 6 years later, he put the figure at 16,000. The vast majority of those cases were in Mississippi, but he has also testified in at least 9 other state courts and 2 federal district courts. West has been permitted to influence juries on a wide range of topics, including bite mark analysis, gunshot reconstruction, wound pattern analysis, pathophysiology, blood stain analysis, gunshot residue, fingernail scratch reconstruction, trace metal analysis, video enhancement, pore pattern analysis, tool mark analysis, and photo enhancement. In civil cases, he has offered his analysis about cigarette burns on a nursing home patient and the marks left on a child's arm that had been struck by a ruler. On his CV, he has also claimed to have advised law enforcement officials on the theory of shaken baby syndrome, on child abuse and the sexual abuse of children, and on the detection of accelerants in arson investigations. Few, if any, of West's articles and presentations were subjected to robust peer review. Most appeared in law enforcement or forensic publications, not in academic journals. And most were in areas for which he had very little formal training or education. Michael West is either a master bullshit artist or an autodidact for the ages. In August 1990, serial killer Danny Rowling murdered 5 college students in Gainesville, Florida. The gruesome manner in which he killed them, they had been bound, tortured, and forced into macabre poses, earned him the nickname the Gainesville Ripper. He'd later say he had committed the murders because he craved the fame and renown of fellow Florida serial killer Ted Bundy. The murder certainly attracted national attention. They also attracted Michael West. By the time of the Gainesville murders, the little old dentist from Hattiesburg, as West likes to call himself, had spun his biting experiments into what he called a revolutionary new method of inspecting corpses. By using yellow-tinted goggles and a particular band of fluorescent light, West claimed he could find bites, scrapes, indentations, and other injuries that are invisible to the naked eye. Despite once telling his hometown paper that he first learned of the technique at a presentation by a dentist from Kansas, West would later provide a more exotic origin story. While visiting China, he was told a 3,000-year-old tale about a Chinese doctor who noticed that flesh wounds looked different when viewed under the light that passed through the panel of a silk tent. According to West, he realized that he could apply the same concept to modern times and with modern technology. Despite his work with both Wallace and Barsley, he named his procedure the West Phenomenon. As the Gainesville murders drew national attention, West headed down to Florida with his specialized equipment to work as a freelance investigator. West touted his ability to use ultraviolet light not only to find marks on the victims, but blood, hair, or fingerprints overlooked by investigators at the crime scene. But his cutting-edge technology didn't do much good in Florida. West generated no leads. That didn't stop him from offering opinions. West appears to have played the Gainesville murders for maximum exposure. He was quoted often in the newspapers, usually accompanied by glowing descriptions of him as a trailblazing forensics wonder. Ted Bundy's trial in the 1970s had drawn national attention to bite mark analysis and brought acclaim to the specialists who testified for the state, most notably Richard Souveron and New York dentist Lowell Levine. If this killer was the next Ted Bundy, perhaps West could be the next Lowell Levine. In his media interviews, West touted his experience in crime scene investigations. He also hyped up the murders, which not only drew more attention to himself, but had the unfortunate effect of giving Rowling the renown he craved. West portrayed the then-unknown killer as an evil genius. "I thought I'd seen everything," West proclaimed in the Gainesville Sun. But when the full details of the crimes were finally released, he promised, "You'll be shocked and amazed." Portraying the killer as a brilliant butcher served a purpose for West. If his own technology was as revolutionary as he claimed, he might have picked up some previously undetected evidence when he visited the crime scenes. After all, West claimed he could find clues no one else could. But the giveaway that West's forensic expertise was dubious is that for all the times he was retained, he was almost always of use to law enforcement officials only after a suspect had been identified. West never really generated legitimate leads himself. Once the police had a suspect for whom they already had some incriminating evidence, or even just a hunch, West could swoop in, find telltale marks on the body that others had overlooked, and then find a way to match those marks to the suspect. As an American Bar Association ABA Journal article noted after interviewing Mississippi defense attorney Armstrong Walters, "No district attorney in the Deep South stands a chance of re-election. If a murder occurs in his or her jurisdiction, and somebody does not wind up in prison for it." According to Walters, West confirms whatever suspicions the police have. While West was in Gainesville, the police had no strong suspect for the killings, and so West and his alleged cutting-edge technology were useless. Instead, he just praised the killer's methods to the media, telling the Associated Press that he'd never seen such a clean crime scene in all his 13 years investigating murders. West's work on the Gainesville Ripper was later mentioned in national publications such as Vanity Fair. When the Phil Donahue Show came to Florida to cover the killings, West was one of the guests. His contribution? He suggested that Gainesville residents arm themselves. But otherwise, West contributed little to solving the Gainesville murders. However, the whole episode did provide quite a boost to his career. He received adoring press attention, which he'd include on his CV, and which undoubtedly earned him favor back in Mississippi. The list of media coverage included, as West put it, "my favorite, Playboy." He later cited the case in court testimony as one of his most notable investigations. More than a year after West left Florida, Danny Rowling was finally captured and charged. He was executed by lethal injection in 2006. Stephen Hayne and Michael West have given conflicting testimony about when they met and began working together. It was likely sometime in the late 1980s, because by 1990, Hayne and West, operating in Jimmy Roberts's morgue, worked on their first case that ultimately resulted in a wrongful conviction, the LaVon Brooks case. As personally and professionally close as Hayne and West are, they have contrasting personalities. They operated in very different ways, but often complemented one another. West can be loud, outgoing, and obnoxious. Hayne is quiet and reserved, but with a hair-trigger temper. On the witness stand, West was cocksure to the point of careless. As one former county coroner put it, West would always say what he said according to who paid him the most to say it. In the past, West compared his forensics genius to the musical acuity of violinist-conductor Itzhak Perlman and described his error rate as something less than my savior, Jesus Christ. Hayne was a confident and sometimes arrogant expert witness. He was gifted at giving prosecutors just enough to make their case to a jury without giving testimony that was obviously false. He chose his words carefully. He would often tell juries that a victim's injuries were consistent with the prosecutor's theory. Even if that theory was wholly improbable, so long as the victim's injuries were consistent with it, Hayne's testimony wasn't, by definition, completely wrong. West wrote boastful reports larded with certainty. He used words and phrases like astronomical, without question, and his trademark, indeed and without a doubt. He often claimed to be the best in the country at what he did, and that few others were capable of utilizing his forensic wizardry. Hayne, on the other hand, typically wrote vague, malleable autopsy reports. His lack of interest in detail may have been due in part to the sheer volume of autopsies he was performing, but keeping specifics out of his initial reports also had the advantage of allowing him to massage his conclusions in court. Defense attorneys who have opposed him over the years say the vagueness of his reports made it difficult to prepare for questioning him. He can't be nailed down on his opinions, said Andre Degree in a 2007 interview. Hayne gives prosecutors leeway to say whatever they want, but he maintains plausible deniability. Nearly everyone who has known Hayne also acknowledges his intellect, and in particular his social IQ, his ability to read and react to the people around him. Michael West is a different story. Depending on whom you ask, he's either a mad genius or a raving idiot. More importantly for an expert witness, West was very good at sounding smart. He threw around bite mark and forensics jargon with ease. He often peppered his testimony with references to art, Latin, classical music, and antiquity. Never mind that those references weren't always accurate. On occasion, when he wanted to be combative with an attorney, West would throw out a Latin phrase or a reference to some book he'd recently read, and then say something like, "Do you know what that means?" or "Should I explain that to you?" The two men were remarkably successful at networking, although they went about it in different ways. West would buy rounds at bars frequented by cops and prosecutors. He'd be the life of the party at sheriff's association meetings. He was a backslapper, the kind of guy who broke the ice with a raunchy joke, usually before feeling everyone out to be sure all would be comfortable with it. He was the sort who sealed new friendships over rounds of drinks. Hayne also networked, but in starkly different ways. For several years, he threw a swanky annual Christmas party at the University Club in Jackson. Honored guests included state prosecutors, police officials, legislators, and coroners. He also made campaign contributions. Both Hayne and West seem to have found little time for personal relationships. Both men have had multiple marriages and gone through contentious divorces. Still, everyone liked Hayne, one former coroner says, before adding that the same couldn't be said about West. By the early 1990s, Hain, West, and Jimmy Roberts would come to dominate Mississippi's medico-legal system. The Mississippi system was run by the triumvirate for years, says one long-serving former coroner. Imagine that. A pathologist, a small-town dentist, and a funeral director. The state provided an audience of adoring idiots. Chapter 8. Entrenchment. Never think you've seen the last of anything. Eudora Welty. In September 1989, Stephen Hain took a plane to Chicago to take the American Board of Pathology, ABP, certification exam in forensic pathology. His lack of certification had been a factor in his appointment as the interim, as opposed to permanent, state medical examiner in 1987. The ABP is the gold standard in governing organizations. Most states, including Mississippi, require any medical examiner working for the state to be certified in forensic pathology by the organization. According to the ABP, Hain failed the test. According to Hain, he didn't. Or not exactly, anyway. Hain has always claimed that he voluntarily walked out of the exam because he found several of the questions insulting to his intelligence. He has told this story countless times in trial testimony and depositions. But when asked to name specific examples, he has only mentioned a single question that offended him. It allegedly asked candidates to rank several colors in the order in which they're most commonly associated with death. For example, Hain provided this explanation in a 2003 deposition. The questions became so ludicrous, I finally said, enough is enough. They gave five different colors, red, white, blue, green, and black. And they asked, rank them in order of association with death. And that became absurd. And I said that was enough. In a 2001 case, Hain told the story with a different set of colors. In a 2004 version, he altered the question itself. It no longer asked him to rank the colors, but to pick one color most associated with death. In this version, he didn't just meekly walk out. I got up, handed my paper to the proctor, and said, I leave. I quit. I'm not going to answer this type of material. Hain's explanation for why he never passed the exam has always seemed implausible. Even if the question really was ridiculous, even if there were other equally ridiculous questions, he had paid a $950 registration fee and bought a plane ticket to Chicago. It couldn't have been the first time he had ever seen a poorly worded question, or an exam that was more of a formality than a substantive test of a candidate's specific area of knowledge. Hain's explanation for why he was willing to just walk out, that he is a man of certain unyielding principles who has no time for foolishness, seems a stretch. I've got a temper, he told the Clarion Ledger a few years ago. I don't put up with crap like that. Nevertheless, every time he has been asked about certification in court, Hain still claimed to be board certified in forensic pathology. He arguably was. It just wasn't by the ABP, the organization most medical examiners think of when they think of certification. Hain gave this testimony about both the ABP test and his certification for most of his career. It would be 20 years before he'd be confronted with evidence that contradicted his claims about both. In June 1990, just a few months before Courtney Smith's murder, Michael West was contacted by Lieutenant Jim McAnally of the Pascagoula, Mississippi Police Department. McAnally was investigating the death of John Schumach, who appeared to have been smothered in his own bed. The chief suspect was a man named Mark Oppie. McAnally wanted to know if West could match Schumach's fingernails to the marks on Oppie's body. Thus began one of West's more gruesome adventures. When West got to the Gulf Coast, he was given police photos of Oppie that showed what West believed to be defensive fingernail scratches on Oppie's neck, arms, and torso. West went to the funeral home where Schumach's body was being prepared and took impressions of the dead man's fingernails. West then went to see Oppie in the county jail, where he compared his replica fingernails to the marks on Oppie's body. After careful examination, West told police that based on his tests, Oppie could not be ruled out as having been scratched by Schumach's fingernails, but that he'd need to do some additional tests. In an incredibly ghoulish act, West then returned to the funeral home and removed the dead man's fingernails from his corpse. He then mounted them on sticks. West returned to the jail with the sticks and claimed that the victim's fingernails did indeed and without a doubt create the scratches on Mark Oppie's skin. West later admitted that he failed to produce test marks with the mounted fingernails, thus making his procedure impossible for another analyst to reproduce. No one could verify or discredit West's conclusions. Not that the entire episode needed much discrediting. It was transparently ridiculous. And yet, the local authorities bought it. After West's positive identification, prosecutors charged Oppie with capital murder and promised to seek the death penalty. Oppie would later plead guilty to manslaughter. But West was just getting started. On September 7, 1990, less than a week before Courtney Smith's murder, three elderly people were stabbed to death in the rural, unincorporated community of Daleville, Mississippi. The bodies were first brought to Hayne, who performed the autopsies and then consulted with West. The police suspected a man named Larry Maxwell, who was related to all three victims. They first attempted to arrest Maxwell without probable cause just after midnight on September 8th, but backed off when Maxwell threatened to sue. Later that evening, Maxwell was arrested for being drunk and disorderly, though his court briefings suggest the charge was manufactured. Indeed, after the arrest, the police admitted to searching Maxwell's truck for a knife or bloody clothing, but found nothing incriminating. Maxwell had a solid alibi. He had been working in the kitchen at the Naval Air Station in nearby Meridian at the time of the murder. His alibi was backed by several witnesses at the base. That didn't appear to matter. During their investigation, the police found a knife in a home where Maxwell sometimes stayed. Other than that, there was no particular reason to think the knife was the murder weapon. There was no blood or other biological material on it. Nevertheless, the police handed the knife over to West, who then confirmed their suspicions. He concluded, based only on eyeballing the knife next to the stab wounds of one of the victims, that the wounds were indeed and without doubt produced by the butcher knife in question. Unless a piece of the knife somehow broke off and fell into the body, there's just no way to say one knife was used to create a specific stab wound to the exclusion of all others. Human skin simply can't record the details of a knife blade in that way. In an affidavit for Maxwell's defense, Chicago forensic pathologist Robert Kirshner called West's conclusions highly speculative and not based on the scientific method. He added, "The fields of forensic science and pathology do not generally accept as scientifically reliable conclusions that a particular knife blade produced a particular knife wound." Another forensic specialist, Michael Bowers, wrote in an affidavit, "I am unaware of any known forensic examination technique involving matching a knife to a wound which would allow a finding that this particular knife and no other was used in the murders." But West's dubious conclusion merely established the knife as the murder weapon. Because the knife was not found in Maxwell's possession, the police still needed to connect the knife to Maxwell. And so, West did. In the first official application of his ultraviolet light wizardry, West claimed to have identified impressions and bruises on Maxwell's hands that were invisible to the naked eye. The knife had a unique handle. It was broken on one side, leaving two exposed metal rivets. West claimed that the rivets made the impressions and bruises he found on Maxwell's hand as he attacked the victims. The knife in question did indeed and without a doubt make the patterns found on the hands of one Larry Maxwell, West wrote in his letter to local law enforcement. The patterns on his hands were produced by holding the knife and striking an object or objects several times with each hand. The blows would have been of great intensity. At a hearing, West then claimed that he had accidentally overexposed the photos he took of Maxwell's hands while examining them under ultraviolet light. The overexposure obscured the very bruises and indentations that only he had observed. This was the only physical evidence implicating Maxwell. West testified that by the time he realized his mistake, Maxwell's hands had healed and no longer exhibited the invisible, inculpatory marks. Undeterred, West improvised. He made photocopies of Maxwell's hands and then drew in the alleged telltale indentations with a marker, relying only on his memory. Based on this groundbreaking procedure, West declared that, indeed and without a doubt, Larry Maxwell had used the butcher knife to commit the murders. Maxwell was held in jail for 2 years before the trial court held a hearing on West's findings. When presented with criticism of his technique by Kirshner and others, West named 3 other forensic specialists who he claimed had used the same methods. All 3 subsequently submitted affidavits denying that. One of those specialists was Thomas Kraus, the Kansas dentist who West once claimed inspired his development of the technique. Kraus wrote that West had no basic understanding of the tissue he was examining, nor does he provide an adequate explanation of the West phenomenon. He added that West's only publication on the novel technique has been in a regional police circular, not a peer-reviewed journal. In the first of just a handful of times a judge would rule against West over the course of his career, Kemper County Circuit Judge Larry Roberts wrote that West's methods were of little value, scientifically unproven, and not yet validated or accepted by most of his peers. John Holdridge, who represented Maxwell and had been a persistent and vocal critic of West back then, had hoped the ruling would end West's career. "It just became increasingly clear to me that West was a fraud," he says. The judge barred West from testifying, and without West, the state had no case. Maxwell was released from jail. By then, the case had gone cold. No one has ever been convicted for the murders. In the following years, Holdridge would represent several more people implicated by West's magic touch. After the Maxwell case, he began asking forensic experts around the country about some of West's claims. Like Kirshner, who had called West's claims highly speculative, others gave Holdridge similar opinions. Maxwell eventually filed a lawsuit against West. A federal district court judge threw out the suit, in part because, despite affidavits from Kirshner, Bowers, and other forensic specialists that his theories about the knife and Maxwell's hands were outside the bounds of science, West was able to procure an affidavit of his own from a medical examiner who stated his confidence that the knife which Dr. West identified as the murder weapon was in fact the murder weapon. The medical examiner added, "I believe that the methods and techniques used was sound and his opinion was accurate." Because of that affidavit, the judge ruled, West's conclusions weren't so transparently absurd as to make him liable for Maxwell's wrongful arrest. Instead, it showed that West's conclusions and those who criticized them amounted to a mere difference of opinion among experts. That one medical examiner willing to sign an affidavit in support of West's claims, Stephen Hain. In April 1989, Lloyd White became the 4th doctor in 6 years to be named Mississippi's state medical examiner. Within a few years, he'd also become the 4th to leave the office in frustration. White, 44 at the time, was running a private pathology practice in Texas when he was offered the job, which had been vacant for over a year. He immediately struck a diplomatic note, explaining that his hiring didn't mean he'd be assuming responsibility for all of the state's autopsies himself. As a general rule of thumb, around 300 or 400 autopsies annually is about the maximum one individual can handle to do them effectively, White said. An editorial in the Meridian, Mississippi newspaper welcomed White's hiring, but feared he was in for a fight. The paper explained that without major changes to the job, White would suffer the same fate as Sproul and Bennett. "The problem is that a single pathologist cannot conduct hundreds of autopsies and at the same time make preparations for and give testimony in scores of criminal trials," the editors wrote. "It simply is not physically possible." Eager to make a good first impression, White tried to relax any fears that major changes were coming. "I want to avoid any suggestions that I'm some sort of reformer who is going to come and fix something that is broken," he said at the time. Asked about that statement in an interview 16 years later, White said, "I guess I couldn't have been much more wrong than that, could I?" In 1988, Jimmy Roberts obtained a business license to open Mississippi Mortuary Service, MMS, off Highway 80 in the town of Pearl, just down the road from the funeral home where he was general manager. Soon after MMS opened its doors, Hain began doing his autopsies, forensic and otherwise, in that building. Within a few years, he'd start to get autopsy referrals from coroners, DAs, and police officials from all over the state. Roberts then persuaded Rankin County officials to designate his business the Rankin County Morgue, an act that lent the entire operation the credibility that comes with designation as an official government building, though it was nothing of the sort. But at least on paper, Central Mississippi now had an official morgue. It was a mutually beneficial arrangement. Roberts could help Hain get autopsy referrals from other coroners, and every autopsy referral earned Roberts a rental fee for his morgue, body transportation fees, plus first crack at pitching his embalming and funeral services to the family of the deceased. Their partnership became more and more lucrative. The careers of Stephen Hain and Michael West boomed in the early 1990s. With help from West and Roberts, Hain commandeered the vast majority of autopsy referrals across the state. Few people bothered to ask how a single doctor could do so many, but those who visited Hain's operation at MMS off Highway 80 got to see the answer for themselves. Hain was turning out bodies like the state's chicken plants turned out fryers. "Hain was constantly looking for any way to cut corners," says one former high-ranking official in state government. "It looked like an autopsy factory. There were no safety precautions." One former police official who butted heads with Hain referred to the facility as a sausage factory. Ken Winter was director of the Mississippi Crime Lab from 2000 through 2004. "I had to deal with the aftermath of Stephen Hain's shortcuts," he says. "Evidence was frequently improperly labeled. Evidence was tainted because it was improperly packaged and preserved. I once had a case where a woman was raped and murdered in which Hain had packed all of her undergarments in the same bag. That's a pretty basic thing you never do. When I confronted him, he just shrugged and said, 'Everybody makes mistakes.'" Winter, who went on to become head of the Mississippi Association of Chiefs of Police, said Hain's autopsy operation also may have put Hain and his staff at risk. "They didn't take safety precautions with chemicals or biological materials. Exposure to formaldehyde and other chemicals used with that job can be toxic. I remember one of Hain's assistants would come by the lab, and his hands would be swollen from all the exposure. He could barely bend his fingers." In depositions, Hain has angrily refuted such descriptions. "The bodies were treated with respect," he said in a 2012 deposition. "It was not a sausage factory, a sushi shop, no. A slaughterhouse, no. I think that is just outrageous." The sheer volume of autopsies Hain has admitted to doing also raised questions about how he and a small group of assistants could possibly keep up. Former Columbus, Mississippi Police Chief J.D. Sanders said in a 2011 interview with a private investigator, "Often they worked on a kind of an assembly line and would have 5 to 8 bodies lined up next to each other. Even my detectives were concerned about cross-contamination." Some former officials have also speculated as to whether Hain did all of the autopsies himself. "I always found it impossible to believe that Steve did all the autopsies he claimed to have done," one former coroner told an investigator in 2012. "He, even 25 years ago, was never in the prime of health. He could not have stood up to the regimen he claims to have followed." The morgue comprised only one half of the building. The other half was a flower shop owned by Jimmy Roberts' wife. When a body came in that was badly decomposed, Hain, West, and Roberts would store it in the back of the building. but some bodies were so pungent that they evidently overcame the smell of the flowers, obviously not good for the flower shop business. Those corpses were moved to a separate building. Hain, West, and the gang called it the Stinker Room. As had been the case for much of West's early career, the press was often eager to tout his forensic wizardry. In December 1991, as part of a big series on child abuse in Mississippi, the Clarion Ledger ran a profile of Hain and West and how their groundbreaking ultraviolet light technology was helping solve murders and catch child abusers. It didn't quote a single source who was critical of their work. It almost read like an advertisement for their services. But attorneys for the people West implicated were increasingly alarmed. In 1992, John Holdridge began filing complaints with several professional organizations. Holdridge's complaints were mostly based on West's testimony in the Maxwell case. He had mixed success. In 1993, the International Association for Identification requested that West relinquish one of his certifications. West resigned instead. In March 1994, 2 years after Holdridge filed his complaint, the American Board of Forensic Odontology found that West had materially misrepresented evidence and data, that the West phenomenon was not founded on scientific principles, and that West's testimony was outside the field of forensic odontology. It suspended him for 1 year. Shortly after, the American Academy of Forensic Sciences found that West had misrepresented data in order to support his testimony in the Larry Maxwell case, and that the term indeed and without doubt was unsupported by scientific research. West resigned before he could be expelled. West's suspension and resignation were not enough to prevent prosecutors from retaining his services. If anything, it all may have burnished his image as a pioneer who was unfairly set upon by colleagues who were jealous of his success. It also didn't stop other courts from allowing him to present his findings in their courtrooms. And it certainly didn't stop West from using the West phenomenon in criminal cases. "That's what I found most disturbing," Holdridge says. "The courts were supposed to be the gatekeepers, the entity that kept bad science out of these cases. Instead, these judges would decide that they'd just leave it up to the jurors. But jurors don't have time to educate themselves on the science. They aren't equipped to ask these questions and draw these kinds of distinctions." That what West was espousing as expertise wasn't grounded in science didn't seem to matter. What mattered was that he was effective with jurors. Judge Roberts' rebuke in Larry Maxwell's case proved to be the rare exception, not the rule. West would go on to be certified as a witness dozens of times over the next decade, and his methods and practices were routinely upheld by appellate courts. "My sense is that judges, especially elected judges, find it very difficult to rule on these issues when it's going to seriously affect the prosecution in a high-profile case," Holdridge says. "They don't want to inject themselves into the case. It's just much easier to let two experts butt heads and leave it to the jury to decide which one they believe." As West's business continued to boom, so did the breadth of his alleged forensic abilities. In 1991, he claimed to match an abrasion on a murder victim's body to the laces on a defendant's shoes. He then used his new technique to find a pattern on the defendant's right palm that he claimed was a match to the strap on the victim's purse. The same year, West testified that he had matched marks on a rape victim's vaginal area to the defendant's teeth. He also testified that while using the West phenomenon, he detected a pattern on the victim's hand, viewable only using his ultraviolet light method, that he said was a match to the handle of a screwdriver police believed the attacker used to threaten the victim. As in the Maxwell case, West was claiming to find patterns on these suspects that had been imprinted by something they'd grasped or squeezed days before. He was not only able to find the patterns, he could somehow distinguish them from any other items the suspect might have grasped or squeezed since. The following year, West's bite mark identification led to the arrest of a Mississippi man for the rape and murder of an 80-year-old woman. The police were so confident in West's identification that they didn't bother testing the blood, hair, fingerprints, and skin cells found at the crime scene. The man spent a year and a half behind bars before his attorney demanded the tests, which exonerated his client. In 1992,